Hello and welcome to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. In this edition of the New York Times Magazine for April 28th, 2024, a feature story. How do we know what animals are really feeling? Animal welfare science tries to get inside the minds of a huge range of species in order to help improve their lives. And then, the documented benefits of Ozempic, Wegovy, and other GLP-1 drugs keep growing by the week, and we have no idea where it will end. But first, how do we know what animals are really feeling? This article was written by Bill Wasik and Monica Murphy. What makes a desert tortoise happy? Before you answer, we should be more specific. We're talking about a Sonoran desert tortoise, one of a few species of drab, stocky tortoises native to North America's most arid landscapes. Adapted to the rocky crevices that striate the hills from western Arizona to northern Mexico, this long-lived reptile impassively plods its range, browsing wildflowers, scrub grasses, and cactus paddles during the hours when it's not sheltering from the brutal heat or bitter cold. Sonoran desert tortoises evolved to thrive in an environment so different from what humans find comfortable that we can rarely hope to encounter one during our necessarily short forays, under brimmed hats and layers of sunblock, carrying liters of water and guided by GPS into their native habitat. This past November, in a large carpeted banquet room on the University of Wisconsin's River Falls campus, hundreds of undergraduate, graduate, and veterinary students silently considered the lived experience of a Sonoran desert tortoise. Perhaps 9 in 10 of the participants were women, reflecting the current demographics of students drawn to veterinary medicine and other animal-related fields. From 23 universities in the United States and Canada and one in the Netherlands, they had traveled here to compete in an unusual test of empathy with a wide range of creatures, the Animal Welfare Assessment Contest. That morning in the banquet room, the academics and experts who organized the contest, under the sponsorship of the American Veterinary Medical Association, the nation's primary professional society for vets, laid out 3 different fictional scenarios, each one involving a binary choice. Which animals are better off? One scenario involved groups of laying hens in 2 different facilities, a family farm versus a more corporate affair. Another involved bison being raised for meat, some in a smaller, more managed operation, and others ranging more widely with less hands-on human contact. Then there were the tortoises. On screens along the room's outer edge, a series of projected slides laid out 2 different settings. One, a desert museum exhibiting 7 Sonoran specimens together in a large, naturalistically barren outdoor enclosure. The other, a suburban zoo housing a group of 4 tortoises segregated by sex in small indoor and outdoor pens furnished with a variety of tortoise toys and enticements. Into the slides had been packed an exhausting array of detail about the care provided for the tortoises in each facility. Only contestants who had prepared thoroughly for the competition by researching the nutritional, environmental, social, and medical needs of the species in question would be able to determine which was doing a better job. Animal welfare is sometimes misused as a synonym for animal rights, but in practice, the 2 worldviews can sometimes be at cross purposes. From an animal rights perspective, nearly every human use of animals is morally suspect, but animal welfare thinkers take it as a given that animals of all kinds do exist in human care, for better or worse, and focus on how to treat them as well as possible. In the past half century, an interdisciplinary group of academics working across veterinary medicine and other animal-focused fields have been trying to codify what we know about animal care in a body of research referred to as animal welfare science. The research has unlocked riddles about animal behavior, spurred changes in how livestock are treated, and even brought about some advances in how we care for our pets. Studies of domestic cats, for example, have found that puzzle feeders, which slow consumption and increase mental and physical effort while eating, can improve their health and even make them friendlier. The discipline has begun to inform policy, too, including requirements for scientists receiving federal grants for their animal-based research, regulations governing transport and slaughter of livestock, accreditation standards for zoos and aquariums, and guidelines for veterinarians performing euthanasias. Contest organizers hope to help their students, who might someday go into a range of animal-related jobs, not just as vets, but in agribusiness, conservation, government, and more, employ data and research to improve every aspect of animal well-being. Americans own an estimated 150 million dogs and cats, and our policies and consumption patterns determine how hundreds of millions of creatures from countless other species will live and die. The Animal Welfare Assessment Contest tries to introduce students to that enormous collective responsibility and to the complexity of figuring out what each of these animals needs, especially when, as in the case of reptiles living in a shell, their outlook differs radically from our own. The effort to improve the lives of America's animals began more than 150 years ago. As it happens, 100 or so turtles figured in one of the most important events in the early history of animal activism in America. It was May 1866, the heyday of turtle soup, a dish so beloved at the time that restaurants in New York would take out newspaper ads or even maintain special outdoor signage declaring the hour at which the day's batch would be ready. And so this group of unlucky sea turtles, after being captured by hunters in Florida, was brought to New York upside down on a schooner. To further immobilize them, holes were pierced through their fins with cords run through them. The turtles would have assumed a tranquil, passive demeanor under such conditions, perhaps making it possible for the ship's crew to believe that the creatures weren't suffering. But there is every reason to believe they were. Evolution has equipped the marine turtle for a life afloat, with a large lung capacity filling the space beneath the shell to enable long dives. When the turtles were on their backs, the weight of their organs would have put pressure on these lungs, forcing their breathing to become deliberate and deep. The American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals started up the month before. Its president and founder, a Manhattan shipbuilding heir named Henry Berg, spent its early weeks focusing on domestic species, above all, horses, the rough treatment of which in 19th-century streets was the main inspiration for his activism. But when he became aware of these suffering sea turtles for sale at Fulton Market, he decided to extend his campaign to a wildlife species that then barely rated more consideration than a cockroach, if not a cabbage. Berg made a case that the infliction of prolonged pain and distress upon sea turtles bound for the soup pot was illegal as well as immoral. As with other mute servants of mankind, providing labor, locomotion, meat, or milk to human beings, the turtle was entitled to be treated with compassion. But when Berg hauled the ship's captain in front of a judge, the defense argued, successfully, that turtles were not even animals, but rather a form of fish, and thereby did not qualify under the new animal cruelty law that Berg succeeded in passing earlier that year. Still, the case became a media sensation and signaled to New Yorkers that Berg's campaign on behalf of animals was going to force them to account for the suffering of all animals, not just the ones they already chose to care about. It's perhaps no accident that Berg turned to activism after a failed career as a dramatist. There's something irreducibly imaginative in considering questions of animal welfare, regardless of how much science we marshal to back up our conclusions. George Angel of Boston, his fellow titan of that founding generation of animal advocates, pirated a 13-year-old British novel called Black Beauty and turned it into one of the century's best-selling books, touting it as the Uncle Tom's Cabin of the Horse, though its real innovation was its use of animal as a first-person narrator, thrusting readers into a working horse's perspective and forcing them to contemplate how the equines all around them might see the world differently. But how far does imagination really get us? The philosopher Thomas Nagel famously explored this problem in an essay called What is it like to be a bat? Which took up that question only to dramatize the impossibility of answering it to anyone's satisfaction. It will not help, he wrote, to try to imagine that one has webbing on one's arms, which enables one to fly around at dusk and dawn catching insects in one's mouth, that one has very poor vision and perceives the surrounding world by a system of reflected high-frequency sound signals, and that one spends the day hanging upside down by one's feet in an attic. Insofar as I can imagine this, which is not very far, it tells me only what it would be like for me to behave as a bat behaves. In the case of Colonians like turtles, and their encarapaced brethren, the tortoises, we may know even less about how they experience the world than we do about bats. Take their vision, for example. Among those species that have been studied, scientists have found evidence of broad-spectrum color vision, sometimes including ultraviolet wavelengths, invisible to the human eye. And while Colonians can see well beyond their pointed beaks, where edible vegetation or predators may await notice, their brains process these visual signals slowly, a quality of certain animal brains that might, some experts have theorized, result in a sped-up perception of time. In Colonian eyes, do grasses wave frenetically in the breeze and clouds race across the sky? Next to vision, smell is probably the sense turtles and tortoises rely upon most. Their sensitive nasal epithelium, distributed between two chambers, can detect odors diffused in a warm desert breeze or dissolved in a cold ocean current. Colonian ears are where you'd expect them to be, but buried beneath their scaled reptilian skin. They hear well at low frequencies, even if they don't register the high notes of twittering birds, humming mosquitoes, or the whistling wind. Some Colonians seem to have the power of magnetoreception, which means that somewhere in their anatomy, perhaps their eyes or their nervous systems or elsewhere, there are chemicals or structures that allow them to sense the Earth's geomagnetic field and navigate by it. The Colonian sense of touch presents fewer mysteries. Specialized receptors in the skin and on the shell detect mechanical, temperature, and pain stimuli and send messages to the nervous system, just as they do in humans and a wide variety of other species. Recognition of pain, in particular, is considered a primordial sense, essential to the survival of animals on every limb of the evolutionary tree. But even here, there are differences separating species. What does the nervous system do with signals from its nociceptors? Does the desert tortoise withdraw its foot from the scorpion's tail only reflexively, or does it consciously register the pain of the sting? What suffering does a turtle endure when its shell is struck by the sharp edges of a boat propeller? As Nagel argued, there is no way to meaningfully narrow the gulch in understanding that exists around what it is like to be such a creature. The strategy of animal welfare science is to patiently use what we can observe about these other kinds of minds, what they choose to eat and to do, how they interact with their environments, how they respond to certain forms of treatment, looking for objective cues to show experts what imagination cannot. Upstairs from the banquet hall, student competitors nervously milled around carpeted corridors. One by one, they were called into conference rooms to face a judge who sat at a table beside a digital chronograph. In one room, a neatly dressed young woman in owlish glasses took a breath as the display began counting up hundredths of seconds in bright red digits. Catherine LeBlond, a second-year student at Atlantic Veterinary College at Canada's University of Prince Edward Island, began her presentation about the bison scenario. She was allowed to refer only to a single 3x5 index card, which she had packed with information based on a summary sheet of takeaways that she and her teammates worked up together, with key phrases emphasized and sources cited, all of it broken down by category. Social behavior. Bison are a very social species with strong matriarchal divisions. Handling guidelines. Prods should not be used to move bison unless safety is an issue. Facility design. Ensure that there is a sufficient number of gates within facilities to slow the animals. Euthanasia. The recommended euthanasia method of a bison is gunshot, and more. LeBlond began by declaring her choice. The Wilder facility provided a more humane environment for its animals. She felt it was helping bison live a more natural life. The more spacious grounds would support wallowing behavior, she reasoned, and allow the animals to choose their social grouping, an important policy given bison's strong sense of social structure. She also praised the operation for enabling bison to avoid aversive life events by using drones rather than ranchers on horseback to monitor the animals in the field, and also by slaughtering the animals on site to avoid the distress they experience in transport. As she ran through her presentation, she took care to hit two important rhetorical notes that judges look for: granting some areas in which the other institution excelled, and offering positive advice about how it might improve. One way to think about her reasoning is through the lens of the five freedoms, a rubric that animal welfare thinkers have long embraced to consider all the different obligations that humans have to animals in their care. They are: 1. The freedom from hunger and thirst. 2. The freedom from discomfort. 3. The freedom from pain, injury, or disease. 4. The freedom to express normal behavior. And 5. The freedom from fear and distress. In fact, it was arguably the articulation of these five freedoms in the Bramble Report, a document put out by a British government committee in 1965 to assess the welfare conditions of the nation's livestock, that inaugurated the whole field of animal welfare science. What made this list of freedoms so influential in retrospect was that it created a context for other, more targeted thinking about how a species might experience each freedom or its violation. What sort of environment will offer freedom from discomfort to a beef steer on the one hand, and a freedom to express normal behavior on the other? Trying to answer such questions in a rigorous way involves considerations of veterinary medicine, but also of evolutionary history, behavioral observation, physiology. Scientists have begun using proxies like cortisol levels as an indication of animal stress, neuroscience, and more. In her bison presentation, by citing a more natural life and avoiding aversive life events, LeBlond was emphasizing freedoms 4 and 5, the freedom to express normal behavior, and the freedom from distress. In the scenario about tortoises, though, freedoms 4 and 5 seem to be at odds. When LeBlanc addressed the judge for that category, she awarded the edge to the zoo, weighing its better health outcomes and stimulating enrichments over the more naturalistic setting at the museum. She zeroed in on the zoo's visitor program, which gave the tortoises a novel method of choosing whether or not they wanted to interact with humans. Staff put out a transport crate, and over the course of 20 minutes, tortoises could decide to climb into the crate to be taken to the human guests and later receive a special biscuit for their service. And she linked this to a behavioral difference illustrated by a set of charts comparing how readily each set of tortoises moved toward a novel object, like an enrichment toy, or a novel person in their midst. The numbers showed that the zoo's tortoises were far more drawn to interactions with people. This indicates that they have less fear of humans, LeBlanc pointed out, which could be because they are given a choice about whether or not they get to participate in educational programs, and those that do are positively reinforced with high-value rewards. Most of the students followed a similar logic and chose the zoo. The judges, however, disagreed. As one of them explained later at the award ceremony, at which LeBlanc took second place among vet students, the facility may have seemed to be offering their tortoises a consensual choice, but it was more accurate to see it as heavy-handed operant conditioning, which lured them into submitting to human contact with the promise of a biscuit. In scenarios involving domestic animals, a documented comfort around humans is a sign of positive treatment. But when it comes to wild animals, the goal is the opposite, to acclimate them as little to human contact as possible. Another way of putting it is this: biscuits might make a desert tortoise, quote unquote, happy, insofar as we can even imagine what that means. But happiness isn't ultimately what humane treatment is about. Each year at the contest, competitors are asked to perform one live assessment, a situation with real animals in it. This time, the species of choice was the laboratory rat. We joined Kurt Vogel, head of the Animal Welfare Lab at University of Wisconsin River Falls, on a tour of the scenario that he and a colleague, Brian Greco, had constructed in a warren of rooms a few buildings over from the competition site. They had brought a great deal of brio to the task. In the first room, where several rats snoozed in containers, Vogel and Greco had left a panoply of welfare infractions for eagle-eyed students to find. One cage was missing a water bottle, while others housed only a single rat, a violation of best practices. Rats prefer to be housed in groups. Feed bags sat on the floor with detritus all around, and a note in a lab journal indicated that pest rodents had been observed snacking on it. In subsequent rooms, the horrors became more baroque. A euthanasia chamber had the wrong size lid on it, and a nearby journal described a rat escaping in the middle of its extermination. Paperwork in an office laid out the nature of the study being performed, which involved prolonged deprivation of food and water, forced swimming, and exposure to wet bedding. Diagrams showed that the rats' brains were being studied through physical implants, and students could see that the operating room was a nightmare, littered with unsterile implements and the researchers' food trash, the remnants of Vogel's bagel sandwich deliberately left behind. None of the abuse was real. Vogel and Greco were even taking care to cycle the rats in and out of the fake scenario in order to avoid undue stress from the parade of students who came through taking notes. Rodents did not always play the role in labs that they do today. In the late 19th century, experiments were carried out on a whole host of species, including a high proportion of dogs, a fact that animal welfare activists publicized to turn the vivisection debate into a political issue, to the point that even some prominent doctors became galvanized to restrict or ban the practice. In the 20th century, as research shifted to carefully bred rats and mice optimized for predictability and uniformity, animal experimentation receded in an issue in the public discourse. Today, animal welfare advocates struggle to motivate their base on the matter of rodents. The Humane Society's website illustrates its section on taking suffering out of science, which sits at the very end in its list of the group's current fights. With a picture of a beagle in a cage, despite the fact that roughly 95% of all lab mammals are now rats or mice. Lab rodents are maybe the most vivid example of a species whose suffering is hard to know how to weigh against the benefits it provides us. Studies using rat and mouse models have sought to answer basic scientific questions across diverse fields of inquiry: psychology, physiology, pathology, genetics. Look into any new advance in human health care, and you're likely to find that it's built on years of experimentation that consumed the lives of literally thousands of rodents. We may now be on the cusp of innovations that could allow that toll to be radically reduced by essentially replacing animal models with some combination of virtual simulations and lab-grown tissue and organs. But it's hard to imagine a world anytime soon where human patients would be subject to therapies that have never been tested on hundreds of animals. No one even reliably counts how many rodents are killed in U.S. labs every year, but the estimate range from 10 million up to more than 100 million. This question of scale especially haunts the problem of livestock, which is an area where many of the contest's student competitors will eventually find jobs. America is currently home to roughly 87 million cattle and 75 million pigs, populations that exceed those of dogs and cats in scale, but the welfare of which commands so much less of our moral attention. When the practice of centralized industrial livestock management began in earnest after the Civil War, the treatment of the animals, especially during slaughter, could be barbaric. Pigs were simply hoisted up and their throats cut, and after some point were assumed to be dead enough to dump into boiling water so that the sharp bristles on their skin could be scraped away. There was little doubt that some of them were still conscious at the point that they were plunged into the water, as was reported in a broad exposé in 1880 by the Chicago Tribune. Not infrequently, the reporter noted, a hog reaches the scalding tub before life is extinct. In fact, they sometimes are very full of life when they reach the point whence they are dumped into the seething tub. After 1906, when Upton Sinclair's The Jungle exposed the industry's unsanitary practices, a series of reforms did lead to significant improvements in the lives and deaths of American livestock. Thanks to the Humane Slaughter Act of 1958, federal law now requires that animals be rendered insensible to pain before the act of killing. With pigs, this is generally done either with electrocution or by suffocation in a carbon dioxide chamber, while with cattle, the method of choice is the captive bolt gun. And since the 1970s, animal welfare science has led to some considerable reforms. Perhaps the most transformational work has been done by Temple Grandin, the animal behaviorist, whose research into how food animals experience and respond to their environment, particularly during transport and slaughter, has changed the way that meat and dairy producers operate. Still, despite years of promises to end the practice, many sows are still kept almost permanently in 7 feet by 2 feet gestation crates, too small to turn around in. And the rise of concentrated animal feeding operations, CAFOs, has doomed millions of pigs, cattle, and chickens to lives spent cheek to jowl in the stench of their own waste, waste that also threatens the health of nearby communities and ecosystems. At the contest, Many attendees were excited about the gains that artificial intelligence could bring to the animal welfare field. Pilot studies have indeed shown great promise. For example, with AI assistance, 24-hour video surveillance can help pinpoint sick or injured animals much more quickly so they can be pulled out for veterinary care. Last year, a group of European researchers announced that based on 7,000 recordings of more than 400 pigs, they had made significant progress in understanding the meaning of their grunts. By training an algorithm to recognize these sounds, we can classify 92% of the calls to the correct emotion, one of the scientists remarked. That well may be. But given what we know about pigs, specifically their remarkable intelligence, which rivals, if not exceeds, that of a dog, to the point that a group of scientists recently trained some to play video games, there is no amount of AI-driven progress that can reconcile their short, crowded life as an American industrial food animal with any definition of what a good life looks like for such brainy creatures, all 75 million of them. The laying hen, among the four species considered at the contest, is the one that lives among us in the largest numbers. There are an estimated 308 million of them in the United States alone, or 9 for every 10 Americans. In a backyard flock, these hens could be expected to live 6 to 8 years, but a vast majority of them toil in industrial operations that will slaughter them after only 2 to 3 years once their productivity, 6 eggs a week, declines. And chickens, notably, are not covered by the Humane Slaughter Act. Poor air quality, soiled litter, nutritional stress, and conflict with other chickens can contribute to dietary deficiencies, infectious diseases, egg-laying complications, self-mutilation, even cannibalism. And even in the best-laying hen operations, including the quote-unquote cage-free ones imagined in the contest scenario, these are short lives spent under 16 hours a day of artificial lighting in extremely close quarters with other birds. More than in the other scenarios, the organizers had made the laying hen choice a straightforward one. The corporate farm offered fewer amenities for the birds, which were also observed rarely to use the dirt-floored, plastic-covered, quote-unquote veranda that was supposed to serve as a respite from their long hours laid in the aviary. The more commodious verandas of the family farm, covered with synthetic grass, proved more popular with their chickens, and in warm weather, its birds made use of a screened garden as well. In her presentation, Catherine LeBlanc correctly picked the family farm for many of the same reasons that the judges did. Again, she granted some positive qualities of the corporate farm and offered it some advice, reflecting, after all, the values of the veterinary profession that she was training to enter, a field that takes on the advising of everyone who has animals in their care, not only the most conscientious. Even so, at the very end, LeBlanc briefly stepped back to ask a true ethical question, one that troubled the entire premise of a multi-billion-dollar global industry. Whether or not it is ethical to keep these hens for the sole purpose of egg-laying, only to have them slaughtered at the end. Among the scores of students we watched over the course of a weekend, LeBlanc and her teammates from the Atlantic Veterinary College were the only ones who, in the final seconds of their talks, raised deep questions about the scenario's entire premise, about whether, in the end, these fictional animals should have been put in these fictional situations in the first place. It was a question that the judges of the Animal Welfare Assessment Contest had no doubt considered, but it also was one that seemed to lie outside the contest's purview. In its either-or structure, the contest is helping train future professionals how to improve rather than remove the ties that bind animals into human society. unless the day arrives when there is no need for laboratory rats or poultry barns or facilities to house desert tortoises and other captive wildlife, the animals of North America will be in the hands of veterinarians and animal scientists like LeBlond and her classmates to help shape their situations the very best way they can. This article was written by Bill Wasik and Monica Murphy. Bill Wasik is the magazine's editorial director, and Monica Murphy is a veterinarian and writer. Parts of this article are adapted from the book Our Kindred Creatures, How Americans Came to Feel the Way They Do About Animals, written by Bill Wasik and Monica Murphy, published this month by Knopf. I would like to now take a brief moment to remind you that you are listening to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now our next article. This is what a miracle drug looks like, and it costs only $5 to make. The documented benefits of Ozempic, Wegovy, and other GLP-1 drugs keep growing by the week, and we have no idea where it will end. This article is labeled as an opinion piece and written by the opinion writer David Wallace Wells. Last year was called the Year of Ozempic, though it was also a year of Ozempic backlash and Ozempic shortages, which could persist for years. Even so, we appear very far from a peak for GLP-1 drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy, which are powered by a molecule called semaglutide, and Mounjaro, which uses its cousin, tirzepatide. It seems possible to imagine a future in which almost everyone is taking some variety of GLP-1 drug, and with a pretty good reason to do so. Probably you have heard about the game-changing impact of such drugs on obesity, a condition that affects 40% of Americans and increases the risk of heart disease, stroke, and hundreds of other comorbidities. Patients on Ozempic and Wegovy can lose 15 to 20% or more of their weight in a little over a year, and if they stay on the drugs, the weight tends to stay off. That may not sound like a monumental effect, but consider that on average, an obese 210-pound man who loses 20% of his body mass generally passes quickly through the overweight stage all the way to a normal weight. If anything, though, we've probably talked too much about cosmetic weight loss and Hollywood vanity, and certainly made too many comparisons to Fen-Phen, Botox, and Viagra. The GLP-1 drugs have been shown to cut risk of heart attacks, strokes, and death from coronary disease by 20% among overweight and obese patients, presumably through the salubrious effects of weight loss, though the researchers can't yet say for sure. Semaglutide has been shown to eliminate or reduce the need for insulin among those with recent onset type 1 diabetes. In a clinical trial of people with type 2 diabetes and moderate to severe kidney disease, the drug reduced the risk of kidney disease progression and cut the death rate from cardiovascular and kidney-related causes by 24%, such a clear result that the trial was ended early. Semaglutide has reduced fatty liver deposits in patients with HIV and non-alcoholic steatotic liver. It has normalized the menstrual cycle of those with polycystic ovary syndrome. It has also, somewhat mysteriously, seemed to produce a wave of unintended pregnancies among women taking birth control, at least if TikTok videos are to be trusted. Studies have shown promise in treating Alzheimer's and Parkinson's with GLP-1 drugs, perhaps by regulating insulin levels and reducing inflammation, and the drugs may yet prove useful in treating many other conditions made worse by chronic inflammation. Some studies have found large decreases in the risk of depression and anxiety. Others found smaller but still positive effects. There are potential applications for schizophrenia and neurological dysfunction thanks to the role that insulin-like hormones like GLP-1 play in the development of the central nervous system and the way semaglutide reshapes the brain's chemical reward system. It seems to bend the curve on alcoholism and drug addiction and curb other addictive behaviors as well, compulsive shopping and sex addiction, gambling and nail-biting, smoking and skin-picking. A compulsive nation has stumbled into what looks like a treatment for compulsion and one that happens to protect against some of the country's biggest killers and curb some of its most pervasive pathologies and inner demons. Americans love to dream of miracle drugs, but hardly anything ever seems to fill the bill. True, semaglutide has arrived with real questions trailing like bunting. Much of the weight loss is from lean muscle mass, which isn't ideal, and there are reasons to worry over the possibility of thyroid problems, loss of bone density, and sarcopenia, a weakness disorder associated with aging. There are potentially other serious long-term side effects, though millions of Americans have been taking Ozempic for type 2 diabetes for years without serious issues. Some of them do report more familiar side effects like nausea. The GLP-1 drugs aren't a permanent fix in a single shot, whether the thing being addressed is body mass index or cardiac risk or the progression of Alzheimer's, but a permanent disease management program. They also haven't exactly cured cancer, although more than a dozen cancers are linked to obesity, and in at least one case, colorectal cancer, there is reason to believe GLP-1 drugs may directly cut the chances of developing the disease. All that means that semaglutide isn't exactly a cure-all, in the vernacular sense, but it seems to be about as close as we've gotten, even in a time of racing biomedical progress, to that old science fiction proposition, one pill for almost everything and almost everyone forever. And pretty soon it won't be just one. Technically, Ozempic hasn't even been approved yet for weight loss, though Wegovy and Mounjaro, under the new brand name Zepbound, have, and there are almost 100 new GLP-1 obesity drugs in various stages of development. Roughly 70% of American adults are obese or overweight, and while not everyone who might benefit from GLP-1 drugs is likely to take them, it's also hard to have confidence in projections that the market will grow only 26% annually over the next 5 years, when over the past five alone, semaglutide use has grown 40-fold. When we talk about GLP-1 drugs as a major breakthrough or even potential solution to obesity, it raises questions about healthcare access, the social determinants of health, and the political determinants of health inequality, the pathologies of the United States and the modern world, not to mention the unpredictability of putting so many people on what may need to be lifelong drug regimens. But it also means, very simply and straightforwardly, that the drug could help a couple of 100 million Americans right now. At the moment, getting those drugs to those people would be remarkably expensive. A single month's worth of Ozempic or Wegovy is today priced at around $1,000 or more, which is more than private companies currently pay per employee into employer-based insurance in total. And at present, few private insurers cover these drugs for weight loss. A group of researchers recently calculated that at current prices, the cost of providing GLP-1 drugs to all Americans who could benefit from them could grow past $1 trillion annually, more than the full annual cost of Medicare, or even than that of the U.S. military. But miracles don't have to be this expensive, and in fact, they aren't elsewhere in the world, where Ozempic costs one-fifth as much as it does here, or even less. A month of doses can be manufactured for less than $5, which means that American customers are paying a 200-fold markup or more, with many of them paying it out of pocket. That suggests one additional way that semaglutide could reshape American health and healthcare. The price of marginal production has never determined American medication costs, but the sheer magnitude of Ozempic demand may force a belated reckoning with the mess of U.S. drug pricing. Perhaps it will also refocus our approach to healthcare away from crisis treatments and toward underlying conditions and preventative care, as reformers have advocated for decades. If this is the beginning of a health revolution, we are still in its early days. We don't know how many Americans would like to avail themselves of GLP-1 drugs, or how many of them will find an unending course sustainable and helpful. Though we do know that a majority of those who took the medications over the past several years have already stopped. We don't know whether the costs will be brought down to manageable levels for individuals and for insurers, and we don't know what that might mean for the government's role in setting drug prices generally. We don't know how quickly, if at all, obesity rates will fall. We don't know what medical complications might follow from the sudden uptake of weight loss meds by a conspicuously obese nation. We don't even really know everything about how these drugs work or what else they might do. What we do know is that treatment for obesity has been called for decades a holy grail. All of a sudden, we have several, with many more to come. David Wallace Wells, who wrote this article, is a staff writer at the magazine and the author of The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. And now with the time remaining, the always interesting Ethicist column from the New York Times Magazine. These ethical dilemmas, as always, are answered by Kwame Anthony Appiah, who teaches philosophy at NYU. I'm pregnant, and my husband says we can't tell anyone about the donor egg. The magazine's ethicist columnist on whether to honor a spouse's seemingly irrational request about privacy and assisted reproduction. My husband and I are thrilled to be welcoming our first child this spring after an arduous IVF journey lasting nearly 2 years. We ended up needing an anonymous egg donor whom we found through an egg bank to conceive our child. Select family members and close friends who knew that we were trying are aware that we took this route. However, my husband told me that he doesn't want anyone else knowing that we use donor eggs and that he is upset that some people already know. He is afraid that in a few years, someone will let slip to the child that they were conceived with donor eggs before we as parents have a chance to tell them ourselves. He believes we're violating our unborn child's right to privacy by sharing this fact with others. His fear stems from an experience in his family in which an aunt accidentally revealed to a cousin that his biological father was not the man who raised him. I have pointed out to him that what he fears is not likely to happen, that this is our story to tell as much as our child's, and I've reminded him that we should let our child know how they were brought into this world at as young an age as possible, using language they can understand. Further, I wouldn't have been able to get through this incredibly difficult and painful process without the small group of family and friends we had to rally around us. It was important to me to be able to share the experience with this group and with some other good, trustworthy, and loving friends. He doesn't understand or respect this, and is depriving me of something I hold dear by insisting on secrecy, and this is what hurts the most. I have pleaded with him to see my side, but he doesn't budge. Out of respect for his wishes, I've now kept it from several additional close friends, which has been painful for me. What could possibly bring him around, or how could I make peace with his position? And have I really deprived our unborn child of a right to privacy by telling a few people about how the child was conceived? And the ethicist responds, when your husband talks about the child's privacy, he's suggesting that the child deserves the right to decide, at some unspecified age, Who does and who does not know how this conception occurred? Yet, we don't usually think that the basic circumstances of our conception are something to keep secret. In the typical case, people understand children to be the product of sex between their parents. Is that a violation of privacy? It's true that people who are the result of an anonymous egg donation can keep this fact quiet. The question is what interest it serves. The way I think about privacy rights is to ask whether someone has a significant, special, and legitimate interest in controlling access to a piece of information. If so, let's try to grant the person control over that information. There are lots of facts about me that I can't stop other people knowing, that I eat food, go to the bathroom, breathe, to start a long list of things everybody does and everybody knows that everybody does, not all of which are things that you would want to be seen doing by strangers. Does your child have an interest in other people's not knowing how he or she came to be? Children can tease others about pretty much anything, even slightly unusual. Having red hair was a torment for Anne of Green Gables. The fact that there's nothing shameful about being born from a donated egg, then, doesn't mean your child couldn't be teased about it. This, though, seems like a manageable risk. And anyway, if your kid's playmates find out, it'll probably be because he has told them. All things considered, I'd say your child wouldn't be in a worse situation if people knew about the egg donation. Now, in this case, as in many cases, there's no way of revealing the information about your child's origins without revealing facts about others, notably you and your husband. But your husband hasn't said that he's worried about how the disclosure would affect him personally. And you've made it clear how much you'll suffer from not being able to talk about your experiences with people close to you. Besides, if the fact comes out later, maybe because your child brings it up, those friends may be upset that you acted as if you couldn't trust them. Amid all the arguments about privacy, we should remember that being able to freely share facts that matter to us among friends and family is also something to value. Your plan to be fully transparent, discussing the issue as soon as your child can make sense of it, makes your husband's stated concern about premature disclosure a non-issue. In fact, you might start mentioning egg donation even before your child can understand. That's a common technique with parents of adopted children. Introduce the language early so there's never any sense that it's a fraught topic. Unless, for your husband, it really is a fraught topic. Perhaps he thinks there's something vaguely shameful about the fact that you aren't both the biological parents. You say you've reminded him that you want to be as open as possible with your kid. You don't quite say that he is committed to the plan. Because in the end, his position on privacy isn't compatible with it. Little kids aren't known for their discretion. And if your husband treats the egg donation like a taboo subject, not to be spoken of outside the family, a result could be that your child feels some shame about it too. That would be unfortunate because your plan is a good one. A 2-decade study by researchers at the University of Cambridge found that in assisted reproduction families, both kids and parents did better when the facts were disclosed early. Many fertility clinics have therapists who can help couples work through such issues. In the meantime, encourage your husband to rethink the episode about his aunt, because that's a cautionary tale about keeping secrets, not about spilling them. And now our next ethical dilemma. One of our friends is a principal at a charter high school for underprivileged kids. My youngest son goes to public school with a wonderful principal. Between the two principals, they have 5 children. All 5 of these children go to private high school. I have never asked the principals to explain their reasoning, but it seems hypocritical. It's fine for them to work there, but not fine enough to send their children there? And the ethicist responds, I can see why their choices raise awkward questions, but don't assume it's a vote of no confidence in public education. There can be all sorts of reasons that they think the specific schools their kids are attending are a better fit for them, and you're not acquainted with the particular circumstances, priorities, and needs within each family. For one thing, people might very well not want their kids to hear them being bad-mouthed by their classmates. If you're curious, though, why not ask? As school leaders, they won't be surprised to be questioned about their choices. There's a broader conversation to be had, of course, about the resource gap between public and private schools. But people who help run public schools don't lose their rights as parents to make the decisions they believe are best for their children. Well, I wasn't expecting this, but we still have a couple minutes left. So I will now read to you from this section of the New York Times Magazine called Read Like the Wind by Molly Young, where she recommends a particular book. And this is The Man Who Invented Saturday Morning by David Owen, Essays, 1988. In this case, you absolutely can judge a book by its cover. Those bubble letters don't lie. The Man Who Invented Saturday Morning is above all fun. The pieces assembled were originally published in Harper's and The Atlantic, and there's no through line among the topics, which include the toy industry, multi-level marketing, trade magazines, the enduring phenomenon of work spouses, Beatles fanhood, xerography, and innovations in frozen food. Other than David Owen's interest, which is more than enough, he is a superbly witty noticer of things, an attractive quality in essayists since the dawn of essays. The most delightful of the pieces, and it is a stiff competition, documents Owen's voyage to St. Louis to attend a convention for people whose job it is to plan conventions. A meeting of professional meeting planners is one of those rare and wonderful phenomena, like the alignment of all nine planets on the same side of the sun, that tingle with cosmic portent. Is it ever? And that is now all the time we have for this edition of the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Do join me again for the New York Times Magazine program.